live from the Carter Subaru Studio. It's the Jason Rand Show, hour number three. About this time, we'd like to say, you made it this far. What's another hour? Stick around. You'd appreciate it. We've got so much more to get to. This hour, we're going to talk about whether or not robots might replace human co-pilots. We're going to talk to Rachel Bell about a new app that blocks you from using social media. And I feel like I'd probably be miserable, but Rachel's going to try to convince me that I won't be. And then Abby Phillip, she's a reporter with the Washington Post. She explains why NASA's top scientist is absolutely 100% positively sure that we're going to find signs of alien life in the next decade. Plus, stick around because in the next, 9 minutes or so, if producer Chris reminds me, I'm going to give away a pair of VIP tickets to a special screening of the crime thriller True Story on April 14th at Pacific Place Theater in Seattle, if I remember. But first, attorneys for Shell yesterday sued in federal court to remove six Greenpeace activists who boarded a vessel carrying an oil drilling rig leased by Shell across the Pacific. The six attractivists, as a stranger calls them, because apparently they are attractive, and attractive plus activist is attractivist, because suddenly I guess progressives are okay judging people on looks. Those attractivists used inflatable boats to get to the drilling unit and climb on board. Alaya Field, she is one of the Greenpeace activists that are out on the rig. Earlier today, she spoke to Cairo Radio, and she explained why she is out there doing what it is she is doing.
I just think that Shell has a terrible track record of going into areas to drill for oil and completely devastating communities and their environments.
So because she's anti-oil, she's breaking the law. And because when you're an environmentalist, it's okay to break the laws, you are looked to as a hero who is passionate about your beliefs. If you say no to breaking your religious beliefs to participate in a, you know, same-sex wedding, you are a monster and you should be jailed.
Outraged that they are going to get another untouched place, that they're going up to the Arctic to drill in an area that it is entirely unsafe to do so.
As ABC News points out, conservation groups oppose Arctic offshore exploratory drilling, saying oil companies have not demonstrated they can clean up a major spill in harsh conditions far from deepwater ports, major airports, and other resources that could be of use in a spill. But the truth is, here's the absolute truth, it's not about safety or competence. That's not what their concern is. These folks have an ideological belief that is anti-oil. And they will always, always, always hold that belief, regardless of the safety issue. I've not heard them talk about ways they'd support oil excavation at all. Have you? Have they said, oh, you know, if you do it this way, it would be better because it's safer? I've not heard that. They point to solar, they point to wind, and all of these alternatives, which are incredibly inefficient ways to actually power our grids. It's not to say that we shouldn't explore that. It's not to say that we shouldn't use it or continue to make it better. But oil is still necessary. And these folks, they will mislead you into telling you, hey, it's all about safety, it's all about all this other stuff, when they should just admit that they'll never like oil. That's an okay position to have. I understand that position. I understand that position from the standpoint of being an environmentalist. I get it. I understand it. But why not just be honest? Why not just say, hey, this is what we're about? We just don't like oil. Stop pretending. Stop hiding behind all this other stuff. Just say, we do not like oil. We will never like oil. We're getting in the way of oil. Here's some more details on how they, in fact, got onto that rig.
We have been following the rig, Shell's rig, for a number of weeks from one of Greenpeace's larger ships, the Esperanza. Now, yesterday morning, we got into the ribs and came over to the oil rig. When we managed to attach a line down by the one side of the rear anchors of the rig and were able to climb up that line to board the vessel. And then were able to use the internal structure of the rig itself to ascend up to the catwalk where we have made a bit of a base camp for ourselves.
Sounds really safe, doesn't it? That whole scenario sounds fantastic. I bet you, by the way, if one of them got hurt or does get hurt on this thing, they end up suing Shell. So where exactly are they living?
We set up camp on a small catwalk that's probably about 15 feet by 3. We tarped off all the walls of the catwalk to make a bit of a wind shelter for ourselves. We have a number of hammocks and some sleeping mats.
How long do they expect to be lawbreakers?
Just dependent on speed and weather and all sorts of things. Last I heard, it was in the ballpark of 10 days.
Now, they say that they're going to be fine because they've got the support boat that's following closely behind them. So they're going to stay there as long as it takes.
We have the ability and the resources to continue to resupply provisions. So we will stay up here as long as it takes to be heard.
Now, I always wondered, like, is the crew there? Are they trying to get involved? Are they talking to you? Are they ignoring you like you're not there? Have they tried to remove you forcefully? Did they try and push you off? What has that sort of interaction been?
They were aware almost instantaneously that we were here and that we were, certainly by the time we were on board, they were very well aware of our presence. They have seen interest in us. They have come out and looked and waited. Even some pictures, but we have not had any direct contact.
Not the best cell phone reception on the rig. They claim the reason they're doing this is really to amplify all the voices to bring attention to this particular issue.
We need every voice we can get. We're up here doing what we can do to draw attention to this issue, but we're going to need a lot more people. And thankfully, we already have 6.8 million voices, but we still need more.
Well, I don't know if you have 6.8 million voices. She says she wants to pass on the same great world that we currently inhabit to future generations.
I am 27 years old. I am from the southern coast of Maine. Currently live in Washington, D.C. I love being outdoors, and I really want there to be the same beautiful planet in 50 years that we have now.
So lofty goals, and I'm not going to get in the way of that particular goal, but you're going about it the wrong way. Now, Annie Leonard is the Greenpeace USA executive director. She said in an email that the injunction request is Shell's latest attempt to keep people from standing up for the Arctic. Yeah, that's what they're trying to do. They're not trying to actually get their job done. They're trying to stand in the way of your activism. According to ABC News again, she said, Shell wants activists off its rig. We want Shell out of the Arctic. Greenpeace USA has the right to peacefully protest Shell's, quote, attempts to destroy the Arctic, unquote, and to let the public know about them, Leonard said. You're right. You do have the right to peacefully protest. That's not what you're doing. You're breaking the law. You have basically gone on to private property for the notion that you're going to actually do something, bring attention. You're breaking the law. Right now, they are breaking the law. You do not have the right to break the law. They have to understand that, right? They have to in some instant. Like, I look at this, it just drives me nuts. And how these folks are considered heroic and role models is absolutely beyond me. They didn't get their way. They've been ineffective in stopping Shell from doing what it's doing. So what's the last thing that they can do is break the law to try to get them to stop. That is like a child. That is a child who doesn't get a piece of candy and all of a sudden throws a tantrum and basically tries to force mom to buy him that Snickers bar. Hopefully mom or Shell doesn't actually give in. Okay, be the seventh caller, Ray. I'm mixing it up. Caller number 7 right now at 1-888-973-5476. That's 888-973-KIRO. Caller number 7 wins 2 VIP tickets to a special screening of the crime thriller True Story on April 14th at Pacific Place Theater in Seattle. True Story stars Jonah Hill and James Franco. It's out in theaters April 17th. It looks so, so good. I totally want to see this film, but you can see it earlier if you're caller number 7 right now, 888-973-5476. This is The Jason Rant Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. Our goal tonight is, because I forgot to set a goal earlier, I'm going to shoot really, really low. I just want 4 likes on the Facebook page. You can give me that. Facebook.com/Jason Rand Show. Hit the like button. You can join the conversations outside of the show. We are very active, the staff, in getting into the conversation with the listeners. Anybody who wants to know what's happening behind the scenes, of course, you can go to the Facebook page and engage that way. Facebook.com/Jason Rants Show. I'm not necessarily sure I buy into the concept of this next story. In fact, it kind of freaks me out just a little bit. Now, obviously, folks are talking about the Germanwings plane that crashed into that French mountain after the pilot, at least according to the mounting evidence, though this hasn't been confirmed, after the co-pilot purposefully downed the plane in a suicide. Now, people are wondering how we prevent something like that from happening again, because obviously that's a very scary situation. You don't really know the mental health status of your pilot when you get onto a plane. And so this is waking people up a little bit and, frankly, freaking people out. And so in the New York Times today, they point to aviation experts and how they're looking at this problem, trying to find a solution, and they're actually turning to technology. And they write that experts are trying to figure out if pilots, human pilots, are even necessary. They write advances in sensor technology, computing, and artificial intelligence are making human pilot less necessary than ever in the cockpit. Already, government agencies are experimenting with replacing the co-pilot, perhaps even both pilots, on cargo planes with robots or remote operators. The industry is starting to come out and say, we are willing to put our R&D money into that, said Paramal Koperdecker, manager of the Safe Autonomous Systems Operations Project at NASA's Ames Research Center. Try to say that really fast. They write, in 2014, airlines carried 838 million passengers on more than 8.5 million flights. Commercial aviation is already heavily automated. Modern aircraft are generally flown by a computer autopilot that tracks its position using motion sensors and dead reckoning, corrected as necessary by GPS. Software systems are also used to land commercial aircraft. This is very surprising to me. In a recent survey of airline pilots, those operating Boeing 777s reported that they spent just 7 minutes manually piloting their planes in a typical flight. 7 minutes! Pilots operating Airbus planes spent half that time, so about 4.5 minutes or 4 minutes. That is insane. And commercial planes are becoming smarter all the time. David Mendela, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Aeronautics and Astronautics professor, says an Airbus airliner knows enough now to fly into a mountain. Knows enough not to fly into a mountain. It has a warning system that tells the pilot, but it doesn't take over. So they're arguing that they should be putting in these programs that would allow a system to take over. The system that says, you know, you're clearly flying in the wrong direction. You're putting the people's lives in danger. You're putting yourself in danger. This is not good for the plane. We're taking over and we're maneuvering out of this situation. So, you know, I understand why people would want that. And I understand the fascination with how technology can make our lives easier and how it can automate certain things and how it can put people's lives in less danger. I look at this and like, oh my God, I'm not comfortable getting on a plane with robots and no humans. I'm just not there yet. I'm barely comfortable going on a plane with humans. I'm an incredibly awkward flyer. I'm an anxious flyer. When I went to Europe, that flight down and back was like 13 hours. There were some points where I was just uncomfortable. The idea that you are flying in a big piece of like plastic and metal and like at 30,000 feet in the sky, it's like, no, that doesn't make sense. That seems utterly dangerous. Let's not get robots involved. I have a hard enough time getting my computer, my laptop to work at home. I can't sometimes connect my Google Chromecast to the streaming from my desktop. And all of a sudden, we're putting all of our lives on the line for a program that's working off of GPS? Oh, that makes me uncomfortable. That makes me very uncomfortable. It's the Jason Rants Show. Are you addicted to social media? Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. I find myself completely addicted to social media, completely addicted to any type of easy communication technology. If I can send an instant message or an email rather than actually have to, you know, make a phone call or go visit someone, I am doing it. And as a result, I find myself throughout the day completely distracted by the technology, by the social media that I have available at my fingertips. But now there's an app. There's an app to make sure you are not, in fact, distracted. Rachel Bell has the story.
Okay, so you're at work and you're trying to do your work, but then you hear the sweet siren song of Facebook calling. Or, ooh,
you've got mail.
You can check an old AOL email message from the 90s. That would be more fun than doing your work, right? The internet has become a dangerous place. Who is to keep us from pinning, checking out dudes on Tinder, buying things on Amazon, taking surveys on BuzzFeed, or trading players on fantasy basketball while we're trying to work, study, have dinner with friends, or play with our kids? Apparently, we have no self-control, which is why a lot of us need an app called Self-Control.
Self-Control is like the simplest program in the world. Pretty much, you create a list of the websites that you want to be blocked. Like, you know, you probably put Facebook on there, YouTube, Tumblr, whatever. And then you choose an amount of time you don't want to access it for. You say, okay, I don't want to access it for the next, you know, 6 hours while I'm studying. And then for those 6 hours, anytime you try to load that website, it just won't work. Doesn't matter if you restart your computer, if you try to uninstall the app, any of that. It's very, very hard to get around.
22-year-old Charlie Stigler developed the free open source Mac app 6 years ago when he was just 16 years old. It all started when he met an artist online who paid him to develop a simple program that would block him from checking emails so he could get some work done. And it turned out to be so successful that they decided to share it with the world.
I think of it as a volunteer project, because whenever I hear somebody say, oh, wow, you know, this got me my PhD, this made my work tolerable, it's really awesome. So I think of it as my contribution to the world. You know, it's my volunteer work. It's my way that I'm giving back.
Around the time that Charlie developed Self-Control, Fred Stutzman was developing Freedom, an app that blocks the user from the entire internet for chosen increments of time. Since then, he's also created Antisocial, an app that allows users to choose what sites they want to block.
Keeping you away from the distractions that suck away your time that you'd rather be working or getting things done.
But here's the thing. These apps are only for your desktop, your laptop, maybe even your Android phone. But until very, very recently, no one could figure out how to do this on an iPhone.
We just launched a new service that is the only service that will work on an iPhone or an iPad. And it was a lot of work to build. The reason why there aren't other people out there with these products is it's just incredibly difficult to do on an iPhone, but we figured out a way to do it. So yeah, that new service is also called Freedom. It's available, if you don't mind, at Freedom. .to. And, you know, we did just launch, so please be gentle.
The iPhone app is free, but Fred charges $45 a year for his other software, since, unlike Charlie, this is what he does for a living. But both Freedom and Self-Control are super popular. Freedom has had more than 1 million downloads, and Self-Control has had over 4 million.
It's really just kind of been a surprise. It did not expect at all that it would be a thing that anybody else would use, let alone millions of people.
It is a prime example of our love-hate relationship with social media and the internet in general. A lot of us have become addicted to the internet, and now we need even more technology to help set us free.
Fascinating report. Joining us in studio, the wonderful Rachel Bell, who knows how addicted I am to social media. I listened to that report and I listened to the app, and on the surface, I totally understand why it might be useful to some people. I feel like it would make me so anxious, because the problem I have with any sort of technology like that is it ignores one simple truth. Addiction cannot just be apped away.
But this one can, unless you go to a store and buy a new device while you've shut off your own internet. You're like, I have to get on so bad that I have to go to the Mac store and get a new computer. I mean, otherwise, you know, you just shut it all off. And then if you kept going and trying to click on, eventually, you know, your brain would probably force you to go do something else after a while, you would hope.
Do you think that, though? It's like, because especially when we talk about the normal types of addictions that people use as an example, you know, drug addiction, alcohol addiction, gambling addiction, you can get far for a point, but if you don't get it treated medically, if you don't see like a psychotherapist, if you don't see a doctor who can put you on whatever medication you need to be put on or go through a program, you end up going back into that bad behavior, wouldn't that just happen here? It'd just be really costly because you'd have to get a new computer.
Well, I guess, you know, you always want to get to the root of the problem. So I guess you'd want to think about, why do I have this addiction? Because I have the addiction as well in a different way. I never go on social media when I'm around people. It's as soon as I'm alone. And what happens for me, which is why I know it's addiction, is like I'll set my alarm clock for an hour early in the morning with the intention to exercise. And then I get up and I'm like, I'm just going to check Facebook for 2 minutes. And I know what's going to happen, but I have to look on it, and then 20 minutes goes by, 25, and then I don't have time to go to the gym anymore, and then I feel really upset at myself, and that's kind of what happens with addiction, and cycles around and around.
Every single night, I get home, it's about 10 when I get in, I say, okay, Jason, you got to go to bed by like 11:30 the latest. And I lay down. I decide I'll watch one, you know, Hulu movie. I'll watch Community or something, an episode. And I'll go on Facebook. Community's over. The TV show is over. I'm like, okay, let me just finish this up. And like, it's 1 a.m. And I'm like, what did I just do?
Exactly, which is why the app blocker would work, because that's when I plan. I'm going to download the iPhone one today, because I was frantically looking around before I did this story. That's what started it. Was I was like, I can't find one for my phone. I don't have as much a problem on the desktop, but I want to use it for mornings and evenings. So as soon as I leave work, I would set it until, you know, morning, or actually through morning until I have to go to work, because there's no reason that I need to go on it. There is none. You know, I'd leave my email accessible because I don't have a problem with that, and I need to check it for work. But
you don't check email that often.
I check in enough, but I just don't think that I need to, you know, ruin my night and my morning by going online.
It is interesting because there's a lot of people who have migrated all of their communication onto something like Facebook, for
example.
It
drives me crazy.
But I do it because it's super simple, and I prefer just to do it on Facebook rather than just on text, or on text and also on Facebook and also on Google Hangouts. So you sort of consolidate. And, you know, sometimes, like today, for example, I wanted to make plans with a friend to see a movie this weekend. I sent a group chat to everyone who was invited. I guess I didn't have to do it in the middle of the day, but I felt compelled just to get the date set. And that's that. I wonder if, you know, we also assume our addiction is way worse than it actually is.
It just depends. If you feel bad about it, then that's not good for you. Like, I don't feel good about it, so I don't think it's good for me. And I agree. That's why I haven't just quit Facebook, which I've wanted to do, is because of missing out on invitations to stuff is the problem.
How many people out there do you think are in your camp versus mine? My camp is, yes, I understand that my addiction is real and it's kind of annoying, but I'm not quite ready to give it up, versus you understand it and you're saying, okay, I want to live an intentional lifestyle where I am doing everything I need to do and I have the mental fortitude to give up on it. Do you think there are more people in your camp or in my camp?
I think there are more people in your camp, and I think this because I'm just constantly frustrated. I mean, this is really a big deal to me. Like, I get so upset when I'm hanging out with people and they're checking their phones, not to check a text to see, you know, if someone's going to come and meet us, but they're on Tinder, they're checking Facebook. It's such a mindless thing, and I don't think it's good for our brains, because you don't allow yourself to ever just be. It's like you can't even get to being bored. You get this thing out before you're even bored. And our brains just like need to relax, man. And like what you were doing, I bet you were on Facebook while you were watching Community, because a lot of people, it's not good for our brains to constantly be doing two or three things at once. And also, you know, they say it doesn't let you sleep very well because of the light from the screen in your face.
So sometimes technology is good, but sometimes it's bad.
I can't even imagine if I was a college student now in the age of all of this. Yeah. I mean, I went to college, my first year was 1997, and that was when I got my first email address, and I failed a class for the first and only time because we had an assignment that involved the internet, and I didn't understand the internet. Wow. I used encyclopedias. But I feel like if you were in college and you were all up on all of these things, it would be so distracting and so hard to get your work done.
I think I was maybe a junior or even a senior when it started to explode and a lot of people were using it.
We didn't have any social media.
Yeah, and so I would flunk out of every single class.
Yeah, which makes this app very useful. So even if you don't use it at night or in the morning, at least you could use it while you're studying or just like during your work day to not go online.
It is a great tool if you want to practice that sort of mindful living. I'd go crazy. But there are other people who are more in touch with their mental acuity than I am. And so if they want to check it out, mynorthwest.com, check out Rachel Bell's blog.
Yeah. And remember, humans are adaptable. You can readapt to not using social media 24/7.
Let's see if I can get through with that. It's a Jason Rantz Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show. A top scientist at NASA is 100% certain that we are going to find signs of alien life in the next 10 years. But what makes her so sure? Abby Phillip with the Washington Post is here to explain. Abby, NASA's chief scientist, Ellen Stofan, she predicted that we would find alien life by the end of the decade. So what does she base that timeline on?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the progress that we've made in finding one of the major building blocks of life, which is liquid water, or specifically liquid water. And also, I think a lot of this has to do with the growing certainty among scientists that given how many possibilities there are, how many ways, places there could be life, and how many ways that they could form, it's just really, really unlikely that we could really be the only living beings out there. We've so far in our own galaxy found several places where there could possibly be liquid water right now, or where there might have been liquid water in the past. And if you go beyond our galaxy into the solar system, we're talking about billions of other places where you can find the basic foundations of life as we know it on Earth.
And we should obviously make clear that Dr. Stofan is not talking about alien life in the Independence Day or Mars Attacks way. She's talking about something much different. Although I guess she's not necessarily saying there's no, creepy, scary aliens out there.
Yeah, I mean, she's not ruling it out, but I think the likelihood is that we're talking about little molecules that are basically the kind of early predecessors of life on Earth that we might find on other planets that eventually over time would evolve into more sophisticated beings, just like we did.
So how exactly is NASA conducting their search?
Well, a lot of it has to do with exploring the object, planets and moons that are in our solar system. But there are also scientists that outside of NASA and within NASA that are looking beyond our solar system, that are sort of analyzing the stars that are out there, trying to identify planets based on their proximity to a sun, based on what we can predict about the composition of their atmospheres, and using that information to make educated guesses about what's going on the surface of those planets, what's going on in their atmosphere, and in many cases, what's going on beneath the surface.
Now, you point out in your piece in Washington Post that there is some speculation that on a moon belonging to Jupiter that's called Europa, that might actually house some kind of alien life, or maybe at one point did, right?
Well, there's a lot of speculation that Europa has a lot of water. And since one of the biggest things that they're looking for is evidence of water, it's really exciting for a lot of scientists because Europa is very far away from our sun and actually quite cold. But there's an interesting phenomenon where underneath a layer of ice on that planet's surface, scientists believe that there's actually enough friction to create basically vast oceans that are essentially larger than all of the oceans on Earth combined. If that is in fact true, we can envision a world in which Europa could potentially contain the sort of microbes that we might find on the polar caps of Earth, where it's extremely harsh and extremely cold, and where deep beneath the surface of ice, there's some liquid water, and there are very simple microbes that live and survive there. So that's what scientists are looking for. There are a lot of very interesting comparisons to what environments that we have here on Earth that I think makes them pretty optimistic.
Now, NASA is actually talking about a potential mission to Europa in some way.
Right. They want to get a closer look at it because I think right now we have some information from some telescope data about what it looks like, but they need to gather more information about what's going on the surface. There's some speculation that this the phenomenon that might create these lakes under the surface might also create these oceans under the surface, might also create lakes on the surface, which could mean that there might be pools of water that are not subterranean. So they want to get a little closer. They want to find out more about the composition of the atmosphere and about the conditions on that moon, because it's very hard to do that from where we are here on Earth.
I've got about 40 seconds left. My last question for you is, why does this all matter? What is that big goal of NASA to find? What do they think they get out of this?
Well, one of the things that over the years we've found out more about Earth by looking at the solar system. And I think that NASA is always trying to better understand the universe and better understand the world that we live in. And some of that information helps us understand the world that we live in here on Earth. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also a realization that as humans, we want to continue to pioneer and to move forward, because at some point, this Earth may not be habitable anymore, and we want to give people coming in the future options. The only way to do that is to push it far into the future in present day. It's what's allowed us to go from conceptualizing space travel to getting to the moon to getting to Mars and so on and so forth. And I think that, you know, we continue to do that as human beings for people who are probably going to be coming, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years after.
It is a fascinating topic. For more information, we link to Abby's Washington Post piece on our blog at mynorthwest.com/Jason Rantz. I've been talking with Abby Phillip from the Washington Post. Abby, I appreciate you stopping by tonight. I really do.
Thank you, Jason.
Absolutely. You're listening to the Jason Rantz Show. Coast to Coast is up next.